Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Accumulating Interest, and it's about, at least partially, banking. We're doing a podcast about banking. Yes. And so our guest for this episode is someone who is actually a banker, poet, playwright, and opera singer. Miss Jeanette Schaefer. Hi. Welcome.
How are you?
Good, good, good. Thank you for joining us, being a part of this crazy experiment.
I'm very happy to.
You know, we've already gone through one computer right now recording this, so it's we'll see what happens. So I guess maybe tell us a little bit about yourself. I could not do that justice.
Sure. Let's see, I'm originally from Venezuela, moved to the States when I was three. My father is Venezuelan, my mother's Irish. So there's a lot of hot tempers and unrestrained drinking on both sides of the family.
Wonderful.
And I moved to the States when I was three. I was raised in Michigan and moved to Pittsburgh roughly 1996, 97, somewhere around there, and fell in love with the city and have been here ever since. And I got into banking because I went to school for opera singing, so I work at a bank because that's what you can do with that particular line of study. And
well, so laughs as well the English professor. But I would think, I think there's actually a good parable, though. Probably your life is a parable, Jeanette.
Yes,
for my students, because I think that was one of the things that happened to me too. I mean, my journey was I chose English literature as a degree because that was the department, or at least the part of the English department concentration where the faculty was not evil. Instead of communications, instead of other things, I was like, well, it was a small school. Those people aren't evil. And there was, of course, a lot of people around me or in any educational environment. Now I was like, business, I'm going to get a job in business because I will get a job then doing business when I get a business degree. And, of course, I did the same thing and became a customs broker after graduation. But I had this great, rich, educational, transformative experience that I don't know if those people, I'm going to get a job in this thing, you know, that they necessarily do.
And I think it's being an opera singer has opened far more doors for me in the business world than if I had chosen another major. I actually finished my degree at Carlo University in creative writing. I had dropped out of college after my third year to go. I had an opportunity to study classical music in Italy, so there was no way I was not going to do that. And I was always going to come back and finish my degree, but I just never got around to it. And then the next thing I knew, I was 10 years deep into my banking career. My chosen vocation had become my avocation. I initially got into banking because I liked having my evenings and weekends free to write and make music.
Not to mention random Mondays off.
And random Mondays
that
off.
No one
which
else except
awesome.
For you and post people.
Exactly. I have next Monday off.
Yes.
I think it's President's Day or something like that. And everyone else will be working and not and getting paid for it. And I will be not working and getting paid for it. And I love that that happens.
Remember when Washington and Lincoln, those were separate holidays when I was a child.
I know, and now it's just mushed together into one holiday.
Into one random Monday in February. I guess not so random Monday in February, but
right.
Yeah, so you get those random extra days off, and I'm sure, does everything close at like 3?
I close my office is done for the day at 4:15.
Wow.
Except for Fridays, we stay open till 6 because it's payday.
Yes.
And I think being a performing artist gave me an edge in banking because I was immediately drawn to the people side of banking. Whereas I think somebody who goes to school for accounting or finance or the real hip degree right now is to get a master's degree in American banking or in international banking, and that's sort of the hip thing to do. I was, you know, immediately drawn to that people side of banking. And if I do my job well, I can help somebody every single day of my life. And so as somebody who's more artistically inclined, you know, a little more socially conscious, that is something that is very important to me. I wouldn't have done it. You know, I've been doing it for, oh goodness, 18 years now. And I don't think I would have stuck with it as long had that not been the case.
Yeah, you're right. And I think, again, it for me, because I'm hearing like the opposite of what I hear from my students, which mm-hmm. is almost this too, like they don't want the experience to transform them, you know, and they don't want the experience to maybe change how they relate to themselves or other people or anything. I just really need to get this job later. Mm-hmm. And it is such a fool's errand, and it is such a, I don't know, such a counterintuitive thing when thinking about, you know, yeah, building a working life mm-hmm. for oneself and, you know, the degree that, you know.
Oh, yeah. And I think really the importance of the degree is to show prospective employers, one, that you can finish something you started, and two, that you are trainable.
Yeah, that is true.
And regardless of what that degree is in, it does open a lot of doors for you.
Yeah.
Like, I went to school for do, re, mi, and to write pretty things.
So, yes. So, I guess, you know, so you're talking about this sort of, like, socially engaged part of banking. And,
right.
I was thinking about, it was in my mind months ago when we originally talked about doing this, the weird Russell Simmons check card thing that didn't work for like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, no, you're not helping people. That's parasitic, you know, yeah. And the whole, I mean, I've had friends who've gotten into the whole payday loan trap, mm-hmm. which is utterly terrifying.
I've done a lot of volunteer work with Bank on Greater Pittsburgh, which is an initiative through the Urban League, a joint initiative from the Urban League and the United Way. Basically talking to people about the dangers of check cashing places, prepaid cards. People who utilize those sources can spend anywhere from 10 to 15% of their annual income in fees.
Wow.
And a lot of that is just fear. Like, what if I overdraw my account? I don't know how to balance my checkbook. How do I know how much I have in my account? What questions do I even ask?
Yeah.
Even if you had an account that had a $7 a month fee, and let's say once a month you got a $35 overdraft fee, you are still paying, in that scenario, 40 some bucks a month.
Mm-hmm.
You are still paying less than with a payday loan. You are still paying less than with a check cashing service. You are still paying less than a prepaid card. And what most people don't realize is when you use that prepaid card, not only are you getting a charge from the ATM machine that you are utilizing, the card itself is deducting anywhere
money.
From 50 cents to a dollar every time you swipe.
Wow. That's scary. I mean, it also is that. I mean, there is that adage that it actually is very expensive to be poor in this country.
Right.
You know, and I think that's part of it. I think it's also, I'm also thinking about my own students as you're talking. I mean, I did have that moment in a classroom in 2008 when everything went crazy and the whole subprime, you know, these mortgage-backed derivatives crashed and, you know, Bear Stearns went away forever and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So
did National City, who was supposedly too big to fail?
Yeah. I mean, and it was sort of, you know, this terrifying moment, like, what's going to happen? And I was with my students and sort of we were talking about, I was trying to do the whole, hey, kids, this is a current event that we're going to talk about, you know, or whatever kind of thing, song and dance that you got to do sometimes in a room full of 18-year-olds. And we got into something and people, I just mentioned the terms principal and interest.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know what those things were.
Mm-hmm.
And I worry sometimes about, too, is it also that just using a bank and you're talking about these things as like sort of skill sets. And if people don't have that skill set already or didn't absorb it from their parents, or even I think about some of my students who might have just kind of you know, grown up in a world of video games, and like adult world is this, you know, there's that phrase now, I'm adulting today, which drives me slightly insane. It's like, no, this is it.
Because I would hope you would be adulting every day.
Yeah, no, this is it. This is it until you die, folks. This is what you get.
Yeah.
Kind of thing I worry about, you know, and even, yeah, in my most darkest moments in this profession, I've had a few of these this academic year, even quote-unquote sort of middle class 40 and 50-somethings that mm-hmm. suddenly are going to need to learn stuff mm-hmm. that...
And I've noticed with some of my... Like, I don't have children, for which I am blissfully happy. but some of my friends who are a few years older than me, who have children who are entering college, entering adulthood, I can tell which ones did it right. Let's just put it that way. And there's this sense of entitlement that things will go my way because I'm a good person.
Yeah.
And there seems to be this hard work is poo-pooed anymore.
Yeah.
It's being hardworking has somehow become an unattractive trait. It's more how can you think or sell yourself into prosperity as opposed to how can you work for it?
Yeah. And I think there's also, I'm thinking about, in some ways, some of the things that I see and deal with, too, is, you know, there is perhaps this unnatural split, you know, mm-hmm. and I had a history, an English professor in grad school who blames us actually on the 19th century and the Romantics, mm-hmm. that there is perhaps the artistic, meaningful side of life. In the practical side of life, and somehow mm-hmm. these things are separate. Mm-hmm. And I look at someone like, you know, Ian MacKay of Fugazi and Minor mm-hmm. Threat, who runs a record label and found a business model, mm-hmm. you know, to be able to make their things work. You know, last podcast I did with actually one of the guests was also from Michigan, so we're two Michigan. people in the same week. Derek, who, yeah, he's a musician and he's a professional musician and he makes money as a musician. And so, yeah, the bastard doesn't have to be somewhere at 9 a.m. ever. Mm-hmm. And I hate him for it. But also, he works like crazy and mm-hmm. he does all the mail order himself and does all the design himself. And as much as he gets to make art, he also gets up and pretty much works every day and just trying to build something, put something together, book something, mm-hmm. ship something, make something. You know, he's still DIY enough that he screen prints a lot of his own t-shirts even. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it's like, awesome. That's like amazing to think like you can balance, to have that sense to, mm-hmm. to like, okay, no, I'm going to do all this, but, you know, not, you know, crash into a brick wall every time. And I think there is that weird, unnatural split of mm-hmm. bohemian life versus, you know, how do we make business stuff life. Actually work?
Right.
Kind of thing, which...
And I'm very right and left brained.
Mm.
And I don't think I would be happy as a banker without my artistic side. And honestly, I don't think I would be as happy as an artist without my banking side. The banking definitely keeps me grounded. Keeps me focused. And like I said, the helping people aspect of banking has always made me really passionate about banking as a career choice. And having at different times in my life been a full-time artist where, you know, I did voice lessons for a long time, some voiceover work, would get paid operatic gigs. And I found that I never felt grounded. And so having both, I think, has really given me a very fulfilled life.
Yeah, that's good. And I think, too, honestly, my own also experience, I say sometimes to people, you know, getting my PhD made me realize sometimes why athletes go crazy or stars mm-hmm. go crazy. Because it's one of these things where, you know, a person gets really, 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 really good at one tiny little sliver of... the human mm-hmm. experience. You know, and so, yeah, when somebody like Terrell Owens or something, or Ricky Williams goes completely nuts, or you know, whatever. But, oh, and people like sort of shame that person or shame some rock star. I'm like, no, I see that. I see. I've been down the hallway from that at work, you know, where it is somebody who builds up. You know, it's that awful, wonderful movie, Lady in the Water. If you've seen that glorious M. Night Shyamalan train wreck.
I've not seen that one.
It's, you know, it's... His failures are so fascinating, and except for like three movies, they're all failures, but they're such fascinating failures. But there's a character in Lady in the Water who only works out one side of his body. And so on one side, he's completely buffed and ripped, and the other, he's like some just skinny white dude. And it's just like, that's, yeah, that is, I know those people. I know those people, and I understand why. I mean, I did have somebody in my grad cohort, I guess I could say, that, you know, broke. Really, really, really badly and never recovered. Yeah. So it's important to have balance.
Definitely.
And so then the other part of this balance is, so what creative projects are you doing right now? Softball lead in to talk about the Beautiful Cadaver Project.
Oh, sure. The Beautiful Cadaver Project... I won a fellowship through New Sun Rising out in Millvale. And basically I wanted to write a play. And Beautiful Cadaver is a play on the words exquisite corpse. It's an artistic medium created by the Dadaist school in the 1940s. And basically you would piece together, a group of people would piece together a painting or sculpture or poem. And they'd write a few lines of a poem, and the next person would come in and write a few lines, and they wouldn't read what had gone on before. And I really, really loved that as a student, exploring that, getting together with my friends and having wine and cheese, and let's just write all night. And
yeah, and I found when playing The Exquisite Corpse, wine is an important lubricant for the process, because... In this weird way, there is this mind meld thing that happens. You know, so I actually have the Book of Surrealist Games here.
Oh, nice.
Yes. And so, like, so basically the official rules of Exquisite Corpse, you need three people. You sit around a table, and each writes on a sheet of paper a definite or indefinite article and an adjective, making sure their neighbors cannot see them. You then fold the sheet to conceal the words and pass around to the next player. The next player then writes a noun, conceal it. The process is repeated with a verb, another indefinite or definite article and adjective, and finally another noun. The paper is unfolded and the sentence is read out aloud, right? And you can make some small changes, but you make a sentence not seeing. And so actually, so the name Exquisite Corpse comes from one of the first sentences, or one of the best sentences, the exquisite corpse shall drink the new wine.
Yes,
the exquisite corpse shall drink the new wine. It's also a great way to learn parts of speech, actually.
I've done
it in classrooms, like, if people aren't sure what nouns are. There you go. If you're not 100% of nouns.
I'd say William Burroughs probably did the most with the form. Naked Lunch was almost completely cut and pasted from random things that he wrote. There's a novel called And the Hippos Were Boiled in Their Tanks that he wrote with Jack Kerouac, and they traded off chapters, and they didn't read the other writer's chapters at all. They would basically just phone up and say, hey, dude, I'm done with my chapter. You go.
Go, yeah.
And so I've always found it very fascinating. Naked Lunch is one of my favorite books, and I found the best way to read it was actually to just carve out an afternoon where you're not going to be interrupted and read it the whole thing from beginning to end.
That's a good idea.
If you try to read it in chapters, you're going to get lost, but you start finding these threads that are connected, and there's these... And so there's certain parts of it that are, yes, a little bit vulgar and hard to read, especially some of the chapters on drug use and...
And the guy who taught his butthole to speak, that one is...
Yeah, that's
my favorite,
And the one where you have the gay man who's choked to death as he ejaculates, you know, that's a really... But then you start finding these threads, and there's, like... equal parts vulgarity and beauty.
Yeah.
And so I kind of thought, you know, having been an opera singer and a stage actress, at different times for my vocation and my avocation. Could I take this art form that I love so well as a writer and a poet? And could you write a stage play? What things would you need to predetermine so that the audience doesn't get lost?
Mm-hmm.
And what things can you let happen organically as part of the, for lack of a better term, cut and paste process?
Process, yeah.
So I basically pitched this idea to New Sun Rising. They were like, that sounds great. You're in. Here's some money. Write a play.
Oh.
Not that it's a huge amount of money, but...
But it's still, yeah, it's a little something. Still nice. Little something, again, something. Again, that, you know, let's deny the bohemianness. Let's get paid.
Yes. You know. And so I put out a call to artists, and I'm writing with probably the most fun group of people to write a project with. Mm. There's Katie White, Jennifer Shope, Michael Young, Samantha Story Camp, and Stacy DePasquale. And they're each just individually really good writers, and they each have their strong points. One of the writers, Kate White, this is her first time ever writing any kind of play or dialogue. She's primarily a poet, but her writing her writing is so delicious and juicy. I wanted to, I actually invited her to submit, and she submitted. And of course, everything she sent me was glorious. So I was like, please write a play with me. And she said, yes. And they each have their strengths. Like Samantha's really great at dialogue. Katie, being a poet, has this sort of otherworldliness to her writing. Michael and Jennifer both are performance artists, so they definitely have an eye for the setting and mood. And Stacy is just hilarious, so talented with comedy. And my talent in playwriting is more exposition, telling the story. So we each have our own individual voices, and we decided what needed to be predetermined to keep the audience with us in this world that we end up creating is we need to determine the setting. We need to determine how many actors, their genders, and their names. So at the very least, that is the skeleton that you need. Otherwise, the potential is, okay, we have 37 characters, yes, and we're in 12 different cities.
I mean, was there like a rule, like nobody's allowed to die, or... No. Or...
What we had determined was they are all adults, okay, let's say over the age of 25. They are not family. And after that, it's all organic.
Okay.
And each writer went off on their own and wrote 2 5-page scenes. And then we came together and then read them all. And we noticed different story arcs that came about, particularly with one character named Amy, another character named Braden. Almost all of us, independently of each other, had those two characters linked.
Mm.
And the other, so I mean, we sort of had this Twilight Zone doo-doo-doo-doo moment.
Mind melt. I think of that, or is it just like, is there a Braden archetype?
Mm-hmm.
I think about that. My mom supposedly was going to name me Corey until the day I was born, and then I became Matthew. And there's this like running joke among some of my friends, like who know this fact about me. One in particular who beats the dead horse. Like, if my name was Corey, would I just be like a totally different human being? Mm-hmm. So is it that maybe is there a Braden and Amy archetype? You know,
maybe.
Can you walk around? And say, oh, those that couple. They're just so. So Braden and Amy, you know, yeah. Or
and then another character, we all put him on a spiritual journey, and that was something else that just happened organically. And so me as sort of the project director,
mm-hmm,
for this, I was like, yes, it works. It's awesome. I love it. And, So then we had the task of deciding the scenes in order. And then after the fact, there were a few things like one person's like, maybe we should make this section first person so it fits a little better. Another person wrote a hospital scene and was like, okay, now that I've seen how it all comes together, there's one little paragraph I want to tweak. And so some of that happened after the fact. After but during that. The actual creative process, when we were all writing independently, we didn't talk to each other.
Really?
I thought yeah, not
now,
at all.
Before, you know, you got the assignment and homework, was there any, like, attempt at, I don't know, team building? Did you go pitch a tent somewhere?
Make it was
leather
just
wallets or something? Or
sitting around the table and, you know, I'm a feeder, so there was always good food there. And we would sit around and talk. And if you have a group of writers in the room together, there is no shortage of conversation.
Yeah. That's true.
No shortage of conversation. And that sort of happened organically, too. Now, some of the writers I had worked with before, like Samantha, for instance, I've known her for 20 years. Jen Shope and I did a show together a couple years ago, and I had met her through that process. And Katie and I went to school together. Michael, I didn't know before. Yeah. And neither did Stacy. And Stacy's kind of a quiet, shy type, but she's got this great wit, and it comes out in her writing. And then because she's so quiet and shy, every once in a while in conversation, she'll say something that is just drop dead hilarious. And it's been fun to get to know Michael and Stacy through the process.
Which is, that sounds like that's an interesting way to get to know somebody.
Definitely.
And I guess even if you're doing a show with somebody, as you're saying, you know, there is an incredible sort of intimacy there. Mm-hmm. So it seems like, is that what it is? There is also the very strange intimacy, and are you then, do you approach it as like, I'm responsible for these characters? Now that we've created them,
yes,
you know... There's that thing. It's the end.
And I think we all get a little sensitive at different points about, you know, the scenes that we've written, and also, well, I thought, you know, we had determined this, and you know, and then so we've created it as a team. We answer those questions together as a team, and then there's definitely times as the artistic director where I have to just go, okay. And the bank hat comes out. So
yeah.
And last meeting was a little too freeform, so today we have an agenda. Yes. And here's your copy of the agenda.
Which is, I mean, again, I think that's great. I mean, you know, the other, my hero, I want to grow up to be Nick Cave. Nick Cave has an office that he drives to every morning at 9.
And I love the office Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Yes. And he has, in the office, he has a coffee maker, a piano, and a typewriter. And he just, from 9 to 5, taking an hour lunch, makes stuff.
Yeah.
And that's amazing to me that, A, he can do that, and B, I think, is as you do it so much, is it just become
And I think that's missing from some artists, is they don't give themselves structure. And I think people don't realize how freeing structure can be.
Because it just solves so many, like, what do I do with... Yeah, I found for me, speaking of banking, I mean, the thing that really turned my life around was a 30-year mortgage. Mm-hmm. The first house I bought, because I was in this awful, oh, this sucks, I'm going to move somewhere else. You know, like, every lease I was in, every job I was in, I could be out of it in 2 weeks, and it'll be great. And I just spent, you know... Douglas Copeland has this great line about, you know, everybody has an awful 20s, right? Or, and which I make sure my students hear every semester, more than once. Kids, you will have an awful 20s. Just get it out of the way. It's like a sacrifice bunt in baseball. No. You sacrifice the out to move the runner over. It's fine.
It's fine.
You'll be
it's
30
fine.
On second base and it'll be great. You know?
Like, I don't really feel like I'm having a midlife crisis, and I guess at 43 that is a thing that can happen.
Yeah.
I feel like if I had a crisis, it was a quarter life crisis, because I remember
I had
26,
one of those too. Yeah.
At 26 just feeling like, ah!
You know? It's, and is it, or in a more whistle moment, is that all there is?
Yes, exactly. I had my existential crisis at 26.
Yeah.
You know? Now I feel like, You know.
Yeah, I mean, I hit a point where, like, now my body's broken, so I think I'm ready for the car. I'm ready for the midlife crisis car, because now to replace my body with in all of its health issues with the car. I need that now. But
and I remember my mom saying when she was, you know, as she would age, you know, that, oh, you don't get older, you get better. And I would eye roll. And now I'm like, you know, I remember when my mom turned 40, we made her a cake and we put 40 candles on it. And the damn thing looked like it was on fire when we lit them all. And then the next thing I knew, I was 40. And I was thinking about different conversations I'd had with her. And I would think, oh, my God. I wonder if you spend your entire life going, oh, now that I'm 43, I realize what an idiot I was at 35.
Yeah.
And then you get to be 50 and you're like, oh man, when I was 50, when I really know some shit now, but back when I was 43, man, I was just, you know, dumb as a rock. And I wonder if you spend your entire life doing that.
Doing that, well, and I'm going to have great joy with this tomorrow in class, because we are reading Girlfriend in a Coma by Douglas Copeland. And there is this amazing point where these two guys, they're 18. It's, I think, the day or the week they or the summer they graduate high school. And they were saying, like, imagine you are 40 years old somewhere. And suddenly everybody goes, hey, Steve, hold on a second. This is Gary. Gary's 18. He will be making all of your major decisions for you. He says, at 40, you would freak out if you lost that autonomy. And, and the character says, that's exactly what happens in life. That is it. That is what happens. You know, that's it.
Yeah.
And how horrifying.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I just had a moment of stunned silence there. If suddenly this 18-year-old is the CEO of your life now.
Yes. Imagine how awful that would be.
It would be so terrible.
I never want to be young again.
I would I think be like, that's, well, that's... first let me put them through my financial literacy class that I teach.
Yes.
Maybe I'll be all right with this.
I was at a party this holiday season, and a friend mentioned, you know, she said, yeah, you just think, you know, especially mid-20s, you make just enough money sometimes to be really destructive and stupid. You know, there's like a right amount of money where you can go, yeah, you know, which.
Yeah, and I remember at one point, I used to be I'm a bit of a clothes horse now, but I've really tempered it. Like, I'll do things like sew a seam or put a button back on. I don't just buy a new blouse. But in my late 20s, early 30s, that, you know, that was I really, on payday, it was like, made a beeline for the mall, and I would buy a new outfit or two every week. And I remember looking at the receipt one day, and then suddenly, because now I'm a banker.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not a full-time artist anymore. Now I'm a banker, and so I'm 27. I've just gotten into banking. I look at this receipt and go, oh, this was 3 hours of my life that I just spent.
Yeah.
This was 3 hours of my working life that I just spent. And then suddenly the blinders are off and you're like,
I mean,
I have stuff I need to pay for. I have, you know, I have utilities in my name.
I mean, sadly, and it's because of, you know, gender things and marriage and whatever. I mean, my sister's 44 and she hasn't made that leap yet.
Really?
She's not. Yeah, she's 44 and has not paid a utility bill yet in her life. But it's weird. I mean, you know, first mistake, second mistake, back home with mom. You know, like, kind of thing. And yeah, and again, it's weird. And it's like, I don't know if she'll ever get out of that pattern. I remember when we both worked for the customs broker office, we made enough money. I think it was not until, and this was at, you know, 22, 23, the both of us, we didn't start making that much money again until our mid-30s. Because, I mean, I kind of went to graduate school for like 10 years and was an adjunct for 7. And you don't make money doing those things.
No.
And it wasn't until, mid-30s that we were suddenly making. And I would have these days where or weeks where it would be Tuesday and my car, like, was out of gas and we got paid on Friday.
Mm.
You know, speaking of the Friday bank run, I mean, it was just like we were, it was amazing. Like we made all this money. And I remember thinking 2 years later after we, you know, we got the house, which, I mean, our mortgage was like 10%, like less than half, I should say, less than half of our rent.
Right.
And I was going to graduate school and not making any money and thinking, man, remember when we had all that money? Except we didn't have any money. We were constantly broke.
Yeah, that's
and pretty... it's like, yeah, and it's like, it's scary. I mean, I guess it's a good, I don't know,
yeah,
developmental stage, but
and that's scary. What I like about the financial curriculum program that I teach to customers or to local civic groups is it's not just this is how you open a bank account, this is what you take with you, this is how you balance your checkbook, yeah, and use online banking and bill pay. It's also, this is how you make a budget for yourself.
Yeah.
This is how you set and meet a financial goal, whether it be, I need a new car, I want to buy a homeowner, I want to send my kids to school, I want to retire when I'm 65 and not have to be a Walmart greeter until I'm 90.
Yeah.
And it goes through those elements with you.
Yeah, which is, I think, and it's also, I think, for me, also, I realized that part of my life, I was very reactive instead of proactive.
Right.
You know, and just adulthood, that part of my adulthood was just survival mode.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just, okay, how do we get through
right
today? What happens today?
And that, and now add to that, we are very much in the digital age. And the millennials are very much the me generation. And there's all that instant gratification. Amazon pops up with a
you
little...
You deserve this today.
You deserve
this today. Treat yourself today.
It's only $19. Just click this button and we can send it to your house and you'll have it in 2 days. And...
Yeah.
So everything becomes... there's no long-term goals anymore. Financial decisions are made very much on the micro scale.
Yeah.
So how do you teach people to prioritize the things they say that they want so that they can actually achieve them with the money that they have? And so until there's major changes to the system, you know, working inside the economic system that we currently have in the United States...
Which is really crazy.
It's totally crazy. You know, you have 2% of the people making 98% of the wealth in the United States. You have people making the most money get the greatest tax loopholes.
Yeah.
Economists proved 20 years ago when they coined the term voodoo economics that trickle-down economics doesn't work or exist.
Yeah.
So this is the system in which we work. So until that system is changed, how can you make the most with what you do have so that you can still meet the financial goals that you have for yourself?
Yeah, which, and I always tell my students too, I mean, think about how economy has changed too in terms of, and again, I lucked out. I mean, mm-hmm. that first house that I bought at 24 cost less than a luxury car.
Mm-hmm.
In a relatively okay part of town. But I tell my students that, you know, in the mid-50s, if somebody had a union job, a new house, the closing costs for a new house in Levittown was 2 paychecks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's amazing. And you think about this whole greatest generation stuff. Well, yes, but also the good choices, the smart choices were really easy. And the system was, I mean, the Housing Act of 1948, you know, which we don't think about as like a, that should be a banker's holiday, the Housing Act of 1948. Because, I mean, that just totally shaped the way Americans have lived for the last, you know, half century and change. 2 paychecks and you could have a house, a new house.
Mm-hmm. And then you have the mortgage crisis a few years ago where it used to be when Forbes would come out with their list of most trusted professionals. Physician was number one and banker was number two. Banker is no longer on the top 10.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the mortgage crisis.
Yeah.
And I have to, you know, I hate to admit, rightly so.
Yeah.
There was a... Yes, there were some unscrupulous borrowers, but there were far more unscrupulous lenders.
Yeah.
And they deregulated loans under $250,000. You could go on stated income. So you have abuse on the side of the borrower who wants to flip homes. Oh, I can't afford this house, but I'm going to say that I make such and such so I can buy it, fix it up, and flip it. And then you have, on the other hand, you know, it's deregulated, so you have a mortgage broker who wants to make a nice fat paycheck, and, oh, this guy's trying to buy a $200,000 house. You know, he only makes $68,000 a year, but if I say he makes $98,000 a year, the customer is none the wiser that I've done this.
Mm.
Now I can get the mortgage pushed through. This guy in 2 years is going to be in a hell of a lot of trouble, but I've gotten my commission.
Yeah. Yeah, that is fairly evil. And mm-hmm. yeah, and you think about it, I mean, there are communities, like, will they ever recover yeah. from this, like, physically? You know, mm-hmm. I remember visiting...
And then just junk appraisals. Mm-hmm. Like, I think one of the best regulations that's come about as a result of the mortgage crisis is banks are no longer allowed to talk to the appraisals. To the appraisers, rather. So you don't have a banker saying to an appraiser, "Hey, I need this to come in at 150. So I'll always use your appraisal firm."
Wow, that's shady.
And you always have my houses come back what I need them to be, so I can get this loan pushed through.
That's crazy. Mm-hmm. That is crazy. Wow.
And I get a little bank nerdy. Like, I actually, my husband likes to joke that he's like, I don't know what's worse, the fact that they make banking magazines or the fact that you have them sent to our home. And
well, you know, I think that's one of the weird things about the modern world, and maybe to also talk about these reconciling of the two selves or the two parts of the brain. Everything is now seemingly about a highly developed skill set,
mm-hmm.
to the point where I think we're all that Hal Sparks character from, mm-hmm. in one way or another, from Lady in the Water, where, you know, there's one muscular part of the body
yeah.
that's like, I can do this better than anyone else, and you have no idea what I'm talking about, you know? I mean, I remember when I was in graduate school not being able to explain to anyone outside of my program what I did.
Mm-hmm.
For a living on a daily basis.
Right.
And it's like, how many parts of people's lives, whether it is, you know, this banking, financial stuff, mortgage underwriting. I mean, when we got this new house, I mean, I knew the realtor that we had auditioned or whatever, like, I'll sign the agreement, yes, with you're our guy, when he's like, I am your Sherpa. There are all of these things that we have to negotiate to climb this mountain. I've climbed this mountain many times. I will be your Sherpa to show you the path through these different steps. And I was
like that guy.
You are the man. Yes, this, like, is what I need.
I want to take this guy out for coffee.
Yeah. He was great. And I mean, because honestly, like, the first, when I first bought that, again, 24, I didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I did this weird... I broke a land speed record. So we had this god-awful landlord
mm-hmm.
that was then going to charge, even if we weren't, if we weren't out by midnight, the night our lease was up, he was going to charge us $150 a day storage, he told us. I mean, he was just the worst, slummiest slumlord. I took a shower in the morning, and the wastewater from the people in the upstairs apartment would drip on me in the shower.
Mm.
I mean, it was the worst. And so we were going to do a for sale. We had a realtor who was awful, and then we were going to do a for sale by owner, and mm-hmm. we were getting ready, and it was going to be not a lot of time, and we were signing, getting to drop the paperwork off. And they're like, yeah, we're not ready to move yet. Can you wait? And I was like, no, my lease is up in less than a month. And at the time, we didn't know too many people here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was just sort of us and the dog, and that was it. And yeah, we got another realtor, found a house, and from the touring of the house to closing, 23 days.
That's a good realtor.
Yes. Well, that realtor wasn't so great. But it was me literally calling people, but is it through yet? Is it through yet? Is it through yet? Is it through yet? And not knowing what I was doing, just calling people. I would spend an hour at work every day at my soul-sucking, life-draining job at the time. Just, is it through yet? Did you do it? Did you do it? Did you do it? Is it done? Is it done? Is it done? And I think it was just I had to push it through. And yeah,
right.
we did get out at 4 a.m. after mm-hmm. the lease was up.
Wow.
Yeah, but but
as long as you were out before he was awake.
He was awake. Well, I made a point of we had a dolly and it was a second floor walk up mm-hmm. and he was on the first floor and I bounced the dolly on every single step all the way down, leaving that apartment for the last time because it was just the man was evil, but I didn't know what I was doing. And mm-hmm. I will say for those 3 weeks, I did not sleep. Mm-hmm. I was just panic. I just didn't know mm-hmm. what was going on. So the person we had this last time was great. It's like Sherpa. But mm-hmm. like how many things about adult life, whether it's how somebody's car works, how somebody's computer works, whatever, do they, you know, need the Sherpa or need mm-hmm. this like now high degree? And so, yeah, I can imagine a person. I will admit, when I was signing mortgage papers, again, I had good people that I trusted and people I could ask for advice. Mm-hmm. I believe I sent you an email.
Yes, my point's
like,
you
did. Is it reasonable to get this you know thing for the sales agreement? You're like, yes, okay, great. You know, but without that, it's another thing about our system. Like, if you take all these maybe consumer protections away, you know, it is a place ripe for awfulness.
Oh yeah. So you have trickle down economics that's been called voodoo economics because it's proven that it doesn't work.
Jeb Bush's daddy called it voodoo economics.
Yeah, it doesn't work. It does not trickle down. It goes into a bonus check or
a derivative,
a parachute, you know,
yeah,
whatever. And I think my favorite kind of customer to work with is actually small business owners. Mm. A lot of them may be very, very skilled in their trade, but not necessarily skilled with their finances. And I find the clients where I can have more of a consultative relationships to be the most gratifying to work with. You know, if you're a mom and pop who owns a grocery store / catering, you don't have a CFO in your corner. So if you have a business banker who's been around a lot, that person can sort of fill that role for you. And what a lot of business owners don't realize is whether you have a free business account because you sell Mary Kay on the weekends when the kids aren't in school, or you have a business account for your multi-million-dollar corporation with 100 employees, regardless of the size of your business account, you have a business banker assigned to that account, and most people never hear from this person.
Wow.
And I make sure that my customers hear from me twice a year, even if it's just a quick phone call of, how's business? Is there anything coming up that might impact your finances? Are you happy with your bank account? Do you have any questions? And if your business banker... if your business banker isn't doing that at least once a year, I would go so far as to say they're not doing their job.
Yikes. Well, on that happy note, it's time for the bottom five.
Bottom five. Tell me again what the bottom five is.
The bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature.
Oh, fun.
Yes. So, regular listeners of the podcast, not you, as we've established.
sorry.
That's okay. Know this question well. Question one. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets this their first time on. Okay. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease would you be?
I would say the common cold, because there's still no cure for it.
Ah, I see. And the common cold gets around.
Yes.
Kind of floats around. There's security in being the common cold.
You know, I'm all about security, stability.
Stability, yeah, there you go.
Sustainability.
Sustainability. Long-term accumulation.
Yes,
of
the
mucus.
Common cold.
Yes,
the
all right, cold. Great. Question Actually, you know what? I'm going to change it up. Question two. Question two. I had one picked, but we kind of answered it. So let's not loop back. Actually, here's a question I stole from the Book of Surrealist Games.
Oh, nice.
Yes. If you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night?
I would have to say night because I like to hike, and it's much easier to hike during the daytime.
Yes. Yes.
So, and it's much easier, I think, to block out the sun than it is to block out the darkness.
Yes, you're right. And things, if things are going to eat you, they're going to eat you in the darkness, probably.
Right.
Though, I always say, how much more honest would Pittsburgh be if there were panthers in Panther Hollow? If just some Pitt grad student out for a jog got munched on every now and then. Like, how much more alive would the rest of us feel?
Yeah.
Speaking of which, so question three. We're burning through these, man. Out of all of the possible ways to die, what is the way you least want to die?
The way I least want to die?
Yes.
They don't really do it anymore, but there's three immediately that come to mind.
Okay.
I don't want to be drawn and quartered.
Okay, that's bad, yes.
Yeah.
That is bad.
I don't want to be boiled in hot oil.
Okay.
And I can't remember the guy's name now, but there was a duke in the 15th century who, on my birthday, which is October 11th, I believe, of 1472, something like that. I'll have to look it up again. He was killed by having a hot poker stuck up his rectum.
Yes! That is bad.
That is bad. And it happened on October 11th, which is my birthday. So now and again on Facebook, I like to remind people, by the way, Duke so-and-so back in the 15th century died on this day with a hot poker up the rectum.
Good times.
Good times.
Rock and roll.
Don't want to die that way.
Don't want to die that way. All right. Question four. This one's a little less morbid. What is one pop culture text or personal preference you wish more people did or knew about? If you could make something in your life that enriches your life more popular than it is, or wrench it from the underground and make it mainstream, what would that thing be?
It would probably be folk music and bluegrass. I think that tends to be what I listen to the most, especially Jackson Browne, who's my secret boyfriend, in case you didn't know that.
Oh, it's a true confession.
and then because of WYEP, I discovered bluegrass, you know, and then, of course, in Michigan, we have the Wheatland Bluegrass Festival, and my friend Sarah from college introduced me to that, and I think when something is different or not as easily understood, it's immediately dismissed.
Mm.
So when you have a musician like, say, Jackson Browne or Joni Mitchell, who tend to write also, you know, in addition to, you know, everybody knows the song Somebody's Baby by Jackson Browne, but he's written very socially conscious songs like Lives in the Balance. He's written a song about the tragedies in Sierra Leone, and a song, Where Were You, about just the United States' horrible mishandling of the Katrina crisis. You might be humming Somebody's Baby or Running on Empty when you're going to work or whatnot, but music that not only entertains but challenges. I wish that more people would give that a chance.
That would be lovely, wouldn't it? But not to do a total plug for the podcast or a former guest, but many months ago now, I did a podcast with the folks at Acoustic Music Works in Squirrel Hill.
Really?
And, you know, they're having shows now. They are doing...
Oh, that's
fantastic.
That
is becoming a bluegrass performance space.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they even have a page on the FaceTube that announces their events. So, yeah. So that's out there for you. Finally, last question.
Okay.
Question five. If you could unmake any invention, what would it be? If you could unmake, if you could take a technology out of the world.
I would probably, as much as I am a fan of Facebook, especially, you know, promoting my band and showing pictures of my hikes or whatnot. I think it has replaced actual conversation and human interaction. And something I started doing with, there's a group of ladies I go to dinner with every single Friday night. And we stopped allowing each other to look at our phones. Mm. We're there to be together in that space, yeah. to break bread together, to have our girl talk, to just let it all hang out. And you can't do that if everybody's looking at their phone.
Indeedly doodly.
So, yeah. And I think Facebook is, I mean, as useful as it is to promote my art project or to promote a band show, I think it's so easy to have faux contact.
Yeah.
So.
There you go. All right. So I will post, when I post this, links to the Beautiful Cadaver Project Facetube and website, and I guess that would be the best place to find out about stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, there'll be links. So I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. It's the best I can do, though.
That's fantastic.
I do have a couple. I have some friends with bands that records are coming out soon, and we're very excited about
Cool.
So some stuff that we're actually.
Did you ever do a podcast with Spiff? I'm a huge fan.
Two, actually, he was guest number one.
Nice.
Spiff Wiegand was
I'm a fan of him because of you.
Yes.
You had him in your living room concert.
Yes. And unfortunately, the music has taken a backseat for old Spiff to the acting. Mm. Now he's getting roles in he was in the touring company of Warhorse. And
nice.
Yeah, toured the world with Warhorse. And I think he's got another long-term stage gig going. And yeah.
Mazel tov for him.
Absolutely. So our homepage where you can find new and old episodes, including episode one with Spiff, and I think he was episode nine, is gonnadiepodcast.com. We're also on iTunes, and I double-checked, and it is updating regularly, or at least the last 10 episodes are on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at gonnadiepodcast, and We're Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thanks to Brett, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.